Hello and welcome to another episode of Peter Hill Explains. I'm going to do question 2 of the 2017 physics exam. And you can hear in the background it's raining lightly, so I'm undercover in the... you can hear the roof, the rain on the roof, and some birds around the place. Now question 2 is, which of the following is an inertial frame of reference? And we'll get into the definition of what an inertial frame of reference pretty soon is. The options are A, a rocket during launch, B, a train travelling at a constant velocity, C, a car turning a corner at a constant speed, D, a lift slowing down as it approaches the ground floor. The answer is B, a train travelling at a constant velocity. However, let's look at what an inertial frame of reference is. So a frame of reference basically is a set of axes which is attached to your head. Say, imagine it as a hat or as a set of glasses, and it's an XYZ axis. And the frame of reference is linked to a person or an observer. That's why I call it linked to a hat in your head. So there's Bob or Jane or Tom or Tabitha's frame. They all refer to it. But an inertial frame of reference is that person with that hat on, with that frame of reference, do the laws of Newton apply, simply apply? Do you have the three laws of Newton? And we'll get into whether Newton actually said those laws a bit later on, but they are something at rest will remain at rest unless a force is acted upon, acts upon it. So it will be at rest or travel in a straight line without deviation. If it's travelling at a constant speed. Second is force equals mass times acceleration. So something will accelerate if there's a force applied to it, according to the equation F equals ma. Third is for every force, there is an equal and opposite force applied. So F12 equals minus F21. So going through here, it's if you have any acceleration in of that frame, those laws do not apply. So if you have simply...
Dad.
Yes? So these laws of physics, if you imagine, are the laws of physics which determine balls on a billiard table in two dimensions, or two balls hitting each other in space, they will travel in a straight line and bounce against each other and recoil offwards, outwards. Now, what we have here is, what we have developed is sort of a hybrid sense of an inertial frame. So we would say that something travelling on the Earth's surface at a constant velocity is inertial in the X and Y frame. We tend to say that the Z frame is the height frame. When we have a set of axes, we sort of get your XY sheet of paper on the desk, and we say the next frame actually is your pencil pointing upwards, and that's your Z frame. So quite strictly speaking, a true inertial frame of reference would be the Vomit Comet, a aircraft travelling in a parabolic arc. If you're inside there, that would truly be inertial in three axes, X, Y, and Z, and they would hit together. A spacecraft traveling without any acceleration going on, where you don't have an equal and opposite force against the fuel being injected. So what we tend to teach at school is a hybrid idea, and associated with so we tend to say if you're in a car that it's travelling straight. Now the one turning the corner is the car is accelerating not forward but off to the side. That's centripetal acceleration. that sides would pulling acceleration. So just once again, a train travelling at a constant velocity, that would be true fully in full X, Y, and Z for directions if it was actually in space, travelling at a constant velocity in space. Now, we go to the other idea, is a Galilean transform, which is a transform between two frames of reference. So if I am Alfred, and we have, I've got a frame, and there's Barbara travelling at constant velocity with respect to me, frame B, I can transfer myself to all the things that Barbara observes to what I observe just by simply adding the change, the relative speed of Barbara's frame. Now that's a Galilean transform, and Galileo would say that if a boat is travelling at a constant velocity, a ball, cannonball dropped from the mast downwards would appear to an observer on the shore to be have thrown with the velocity of the boat, and so the observer on the floor on the on the shore would see the cannonball drop. Now essentially special relativity says that you can't actually just simply apply the Galilean transforms, because that would mean that I could push a frame off at 1 meter per second, stand on that frame, and then push another thing off at the next meter per second, and ad nauseum way up beyond the actual speed of light. So the important thing is that the Galilean transforms work at low velocity, but at high velocity you have to have special relativity. But special relativity itself only works in an inertial frame. So that, just unpacking that for the moment. Go through. Now we're up to question number 3. And it says, which of the following correctly shows the electric field between parallel charged plates? And they have A, and you have a bottom plate with little plus signs in the middle of it, and above it there are three plus signs, and above it are three arrows equally spaced, and they're all on straight lines, and there is a filled arrowhead at the end of these arrows. So they, this is at the top, and that touches the very tip, and there's no gap to it, to the plate above, which is negatively charged. It's got three negative signs there. Now, I suppose quite interestingly, these are very large signs. B shows the same configuration of plates, but the arrows start at the right and travel fully left. C, the arrows start at the minus signs at the top and go down with the arrowheads just touching the positive plate underneath, and D is the arrows starting at the left, three arrows starting and going to the right, and so they don't touch anything in particular. Now the correct answer for that is A, the arrows start at the positive plate and end at the negative plate, and that's just the convention of drawing electric field lines. We have decided by convention we will attribute the number of field lines, one field line for the same unit of charge, surface area of charge, charge there, and the field lines will start at a positive charge and somewhere in the universe finish at a negative charge. So A is the most correct answer. However, there are a few minor points here. Conductors, so this is a good quick demonstration, but what we have here is the positive charges and or negative charges floating within the body of a conductor. And what an actual does happen is that the charges are free to move within the conductor, repel each other, and wind up equally on the surface of the conductor. Now, if there was no other negative plate, the charges would uniformly arrange themselves on the plate at the top and the bottom. However, with a negative plate above, they would be attracted. And similarly to the negative charges. So really the negative charges and the positive charges should actually be pushed closer to each other, or as close as possible, to indicate that they're on the surface. Although it is convention to actually have the lines going from a positive, an actual individual positive charge to a negative charge, it is actually not required that the number of charges equal the number of field lines. It's just that they're in proportion. So that's a convention. Another really important thing is that because field lines are not vector arrows or anything like that, they're a line of force, so to speak, invented by none other than our friend Faraday. And yeah, we'll get into the fact that Faraday himself discovered that they were not scientifically correct after discussing them at length with Faraday. Sorry, not Faraday, with James Clerk Maxwell, who went on to develop a full electromagnetic theory without them. And Faraday himself gave up formal pursuit of science and followed a more educational view to science when he discovered the field lines were not scientifically relevant. In fact, let's step back again. Maxwell, when he was writing the eulogy, or the, death note for Faraday in a scientific journal about Faraday, said they were sort of ancient lines from an ancient civilization, sort of indicating a concept which is actually, I suppose, not scientifically based. And it is interesting that Faraday, who used to produce those copperplate prints and of religious prints, would show the rays coming out of, I suppose, holy or divine objects and etch those lines, was able to very physically understand this metaphor which is here. But getting back to it, the convention is that you put an open arrow halfway through a line. So rather than the arrowheads, conventionally you would actually place the arrow midway through the line to indicate the direction of force, the direction that a positive particle would travel. So the way that a line of force is indicated is that if I had a this is hard to understand, an infinitely heavy positive charge, where would it actually travel? So if you imagine something's light, it would speed up and actually deviate, wouldn't be able to follow a field line around. This is an infinitely heavy particle, so where would it move? Or if it moved a small point, you stop it every time, so it never achieves any noticeable velocity. So another way of thinking is if the area space was filled with molasses and you had a positive charge, where would that positive charge go over a long length of time? That's between plates. You sort of get a real good understanding of that if you produce computer simulations of these field lines. They're very useful graphically to show electric field, but you have to sort of understand it a bit more. Question 4, an asteroid mass 75 kilograms, and that's good, they've got a space there, lands on planet X, and it's also good that they've actually put an italic X there. Her weight is 630 newtons, capital N there. What is the acceleration due to gravity in meters per second squared? And they've got an M space S to the minus 2. Now, in modern convention now, you should actually have something called a midpoint between the two units. So the modern SI standard of expressing units is to have a midpoint there, but we still have the old convention here in physics on planet X. If she was on Earth, 75 kilograms would have an acceleration of roughly 750 newtons. So there's 10 newtons per kilogram force down. So because there's less, 630 is a little bit less, the actual acceleration due to gravity is a little bit less than the acceleration to gravity on Earth, which is 9.8 meters per second squared downwards. So if I was able to drop something out of my hand, it would begin to accelerate at 9.8 meters per second squared. So we look at the different options. There's A, 0.12, B, 8.4, C, 9.8, D, 735 meters per second. The answer is 8.5, 9.8 is the acceleration due to Earth. So this basically asks, do you understand a Newton, and do you understand the acceleration due to Earth is 9.8? Question number five, electric current flows in undoped silicon. Which statement is true? So, silicon is a semiconductor. It has a valence band on the bottom, a band gap, and a conduction band. And the valence band is fully full of electrons. Each electron, it's hard to say, has an energy, or I suppose more correctly, a momentum, and it can't increase its momentum quite simply because it encounters a band gap. The band gap is due to the periodicity of the lattice. So when the lattice electrons, so if you imagine electrons as a wave, when that wavelength corresponds to the actual spacing of positive charges, it means that the electrons, as it sort of travels, always hits a positive charge, and so that depresses the energy. So there's an energy gap there. So it says, so in pure undoped silicon, you have a full valence band and an empty conduction band. So there's no introduction of impurities, which creates acceptors or donors there. Which statement about this current is true? About the current, the number of electrons moving exceeds the number of holes moving. B, the number of holes moving exceeds the number of electrons moving. Equal number of holes and electrons are moving in the same direction. Equal number of holes and electrons are moving in an opposite direction. this particular thing is that in order to get conduction, you have to have a hole electron pair, that is an electron removed from the valence band, over or above have an energy which exceeds it. It goes into a state which is in the conduction band, and when it goes up into the conduction band, it leaves a hole behind. Now there's this concept that this picture is of actually physical electrons, but it's actually a quantum mechanical picture. I'll get in trouble for this, but this is fully explained in my YouTube video, The Band Gap in 3D. And so this is perhaps where an expert view is not the best tutoring for, I suppose, people sitting these exams. But the answer here is that the D, there's an equal number of holes and electrons are moving in opposite directions. There's an equal number because it's undoped silicon. Artists have to remember whether it's an intrinsic or extrinsic semiconductor. There's a term there, and I'll have to actually remember the actual definition there. And there is a view that for current, and this is basically a misconception taught at school, that for a current to actually flow, the actual holes migrate through, I suppose, quantum number space from left to right, that there's that the actual quantum chart has electrodes on either side of it. But each state there actually represents an electron travelling at a velocity, not a stationary electron. So it's a sort of a deeply, deeply confused part of the physics course taught here. I am a quantum physicist, so you know, I'm sort of like a Robinson Crusoe trying to explain what's going on here. Now, so just to cover that again, the number of electrons and number of holes are moving are equal. And now, again, that's a very difficult thing. This is, if you, I suppose the correct term is, rather than say the number of electrons, is the number of charge carriers would be a little better. So things that this is charge, effective charges which contribute to the current. Now, by definition, like if a electron positioned, drawn in the valence band is not physically an electron, because the actual axes, we're looking at a three-dimensional graph, the dimensions are energy, momentum and quantum number, but they're actually not physically, you know, once it's up there, that defines an electron with a particular energy and obviously a particular momentum, which is associated with that quantum number. And therefore, even though it's stationary on the page, that is a way, like a graph of a particle which is measuring, like if you had to do a graph of cars travelling on a freeway and the number of cars travelling at a particular velocity, even though the number of cars travelling at 60 kilometres an hour on the graph is still, it's a still point, it represents electrons travelling at a particular velocity. Very difficult. I've never actually ever tried to explain that to fellow teachers on there, but look, I am very confident on that. So just to make it simple, the answer that the HSC wants from you is that there's equal number of holes and electrons are moving in opposite directions. Question 6. Which of the following best represents the structure of a metallic lattice? And so we have four pictures of different number of ions, metallic ions, iron cores, so to speak, and that's represented by a circle with a plus sign in it, and inside the lattice is a two-dimensional structure. And as well as the iron cores, we have electrons with an E and a minus sign. And so we have here A has a box with a central point into it, so that's 5 points of positive ions and 4 electrons. So it's a relatively balanced quantity of electrons, and one could assume that there's a symmetry here, even though there's unbalanced numbers. It's just the way that we have actually selected to draw this in the framing of this, that overall there'd be an equally balanced amount, and the electrons are in the gap between the positive ions, and they're just dead in the center. Now B is a picture with a little few more ions. It's it's got 9 ions, 3 on the top, 3 middle, 3 at the bottom, and they have a bevy, it looks like, for 9 ions, they have 9 electrons. Let's count them, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, so that's 9 electrons. So even though visually it looks as though the electrons are together, there's actually more, the same number of electrons there. Now, again, it's the framing of it. C is a picture close to the model, and I think this is, I've only ever seen this in the HSC reference of Cooper pair electrons. Two electron pairs come together, and as they come together, the lattice moves sufficiently together in a localized area, such that it creates sort of like a strong positive field, which allows the electrons to attract to each other, and they're traveling in the same direction. So this is sort of a classical explanation. So for there's 4 electrons and 9 positive charges. At D, you have 3 electrons at the top and 6 charges down the bottom. So the one which wins in terms of equal number of charges, even though it's a bit hard to see, is B, giving the idea that electrons are moving around the place. A is less correct because the electrons don't appear to be moving and just bouncing around the place. They appear to be fixed and stationary, and there's fewer of them. This obviously deserves some sort of criticism. This is the Drude electron, ion lattice model, developed, I think, in 1901, and it survived in the scientific community, I think, less than a year before it was given up. And at this time, the electron had just been discovered, and they discovered that it was a small particle. They didn't actually have an idea of the nucleus, so they had an idea that the atom was a positive sphere, and Drude came up with this idea of the electrons somehow ballistically traveling through the lattice. The electric field was sort of described as a top hat. Now, so the electrons would have this sort of space between the electric field. It wasn't generally accepted as a scientific theory after 1901, and it's obviously been replaced with quantum mechanics. So you have the electrons able to sort of bounce like a ball bearing through some sort of pinball machine and go through, and it's a very visual way of currents. So if it imagines the electrons as these little tiny classical particles, and if you apply a field for it, you can actually push them through pretty much like a gas going through a lattice. I'll just move on. We're question number 6. So the answer there is B, because there's a equal number of electrons and positive charges, so it's equally charged, and the electrons are travelling through. So that's the Drude model from 1901. I quite honestly don't see why, when people see this, they look up the literature. I don't understand why they don't do this. Question number 7. Which of the following is the correct statement about the Michelson-Morley experiment? So the Michelson-Morley experiment was monochromatic light of a particular wavelength, and it was fired up 2 paths of split at right angles, and fired along the x-axis and y-axis. Remember that we have the z-axis as our vertical axis. And what this effectively did is that you split the light in two, and if those 2 paths are different by a fraction of wavelength, when that light reconstructs, it and goes through the half mirror again, you'll have to actually study this, it destructively interferes, it can destructively interfere and create a fringe or decrease the amount of light reaching a detector. And of course you say, where does the additional light goes? Well, it can then constructively interfere and you get actually more light travelling back towards the light source. So this interferometer measures